Hi, everyone. Welcome to This Week in Mormons. I'm excited to be here with y'all.
Jeff, are you in Asheville, North Carolina?
There's no such place. No darn place. No, it doesn't exist. But I've been driving my dear wife crazy with my accents during this journey to the south, the southern part of America.
And, I already hate it.
Yeah, I understand that too. Everyone hates it. So anyway, even the locals hate it, surprisingly and shockingly. I come to you from Asheville, North Carolina. A little bit of a stop over here. I spent the week in Nashville. Stop squeaking. Stop it.
Sorry, that was one time.
My goodness. I'm in Asheville, North Carolina right now, and we'll be heading back to D.C. tomorrow. I've had a delightful time hanging out. We saw the Biltmore Estate today. I don't know if you're familiar with the Biltmore, Al, or not.
I don't
know.
For
our listeners. The Biltmore is, I believe, like the largest house in America, or what, something like that. It was built by the Vanderbilt family in the late 1800s. It is a giant, amazing, crazy chateau-like structure, but it's humongous. I mean, like, their dining room was modeled after a medieval castle, giant, like, banquet hall. So it's 7 stories tall. It has the long table and authentic tapestries and three humongous fireplaces that take up the whole wall. There's an organ in that room as well. And so we did the whole tour, and it's a remarkable building. Very, very cool to check out. I imagine some of our listeners have been there before. So we decided to check that out on our way back from Nashville, do a quick little stop over here in North Carolina before we head back up. And it's been real.
Ooh.
Asheville,
Jeff, that's
is
exciting.
We also... we drove through Smoky Mountains National Park, and I drove up to the highest peak in the park, which name escapes me at this moment in time, and we climbed
Everest.
It was
K5.
It was Mount Everest and K2 altogether. All of them together. No, it was I can find it here. There we go. Klingman's Dome.
Mount Doom.
We climbed Klingman's Dome, which was fun. Nice steep hike. They've got this viewing platform. Smoky Mountains are great. And Nashville was great. Loved it. Also, Al, have you ever been to Pigeon Forge, Tennessee?
No.
One goes through...
Should I go to the Pigeon Forge in Tennessee?
Well, one goes through Pigeon Forge to go through the Smoky Mountains. It's also the home of Dollywood, Pigeon Forge. We skipped Dollywood, unfortunately, and that's okay. I will go there someday, I'm sure, and enjoy country kitsch at its finest. But Pigeon Forge is like Myrtle Beach in the Appalachians. We're talking miniature golf courses everywhere, go-kart tracks, crazy buildings with King Kong on them. There was some Jurassic boat ride. The best thing was I didn't expect it to be that over the top, and Danielle was like blown away. She was working on her computer and looked up, and I think her exact words were something like, I don't know how to react to what I'm seeing right now. It scared her. It was awesome. It was great. So I'm loving the South. Oh, these people, they're wonderful. It's amazing.
They sound delightful. The South has always treated us well. You know, when you think of it, Jeff, every time we've gone South, we come away with great stories, good food, and fabulous beaches with drunk smokers.
Well, that's mostly just Myrtle Beach, which is kind of a cesspool.
And beaches in every other southern state.
Yeah. Have you ever been to Nashville, Al?
Nashville. I've driven through it. I didn't stop.
Cool town, actually. I enjoyed my time in Nashville. Good city. Good people, great food, good music.
I feel like all you do anymore, Jeff, all you do is just live this glamorous life. Every time I ask you, hey, Jeff, what did you do this week? It's always some other trip, some big thing that you're doing.
That's what it is. Yeah, it's usually nothing like, oh, we hung out and watched Friends and Dawson's Creek.
And then played headbands.
Yeah, and then got a good game of signs.
No, you're traipsing about the country. I get check-ins from you in Nashville and Memphis.
I only get to traipse because my wife travels for work and I can telecommute pretty easily. So I just go along and it works.
Why do you say travel for work in quotes? What does that mean?
She's traveling for work. There are no quotes.
What kind of work is this, Jeff?
Conference attendance, my friend.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, her special conference in these special southern cities with loose laws. I see.
Yeah, well, I like anyone
wink,
would
wink,
know.
Wink, Jeff, I get it. I get it.
I bet... I bet many of our listeners have been to conferences, and we all know that conferences
generally really, we go to conferences as a people.
Yeah, they involve like 60% maybe of like time well spent, maybe.
No, come on. I'll give you 15%. Even our LDS general conference, we're at maybe a trim 35%.
Anyway, but you know what I mean. Conferences are good and there's stuff to learn, but people go to conferences because it's like going on a cruise without the boat.
I mean, oh, finally.
You goof.
That's what I've been looking for. I've been trying to get a cruise without the boat.
I'm telling you, it's nothing but middle-aged people trying to reclaim their youth by drinking too much and enjoying the open bar and watching them line dance, which is really exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness. Anyway, I won't bore you with all of the other wonderful things I did in Nashville. But
well, don't stop now. What else happened?
Al, no one cares. Okay, for our followers, for anyone who watches the show Nashville, which Al does not like, even though I guarantee he's never sat through an episode. But
I've never sat through an episode.
So they were slated to play a concert as part of the opening festivities of this conference. And I got some guy named Dierks Bentley was the headliner. I don't even care about him. But one of the guys from Nashville, Chip Esten, who also used to be on Whose Line Is It Anyway? A lot of other things, you know?
He's the not funny guy.
He plays a great character on Nashville, and some other girl was going to sing. But we had all this rain, crazy heavy storms through town the whole night. So no one knew what was going to happen. So we went across the street to this little bar where the opening band was playing. And who's on the stage? One of the other actors from Nashville. And then we saw a bunch of the actors from the show hanging out in the corner. And so we went over there and stood by them. And they all just kind of took turns filling time. This opening band was supposed to play for half an hour. So these Nashville actors just got up and played music on their own just to entertain people while it was raining and there was nothing else to do. And not everyone knew about it. We just sat there and like hung out and smiled at them. And Danielle got more starstruck than I've ever seen her in my life. It was actually really funny.
You were awful smiley, I bet.
It was a great night. What can I say? Gunner.
Who's the girl? Gunner. Who's the, like, your Instagram, man, you put like 9 photos of the exact same event up all in a row.
Yeah, that was my vantage point right there. It was great.
And I was like,
who was the girl who responded to your mean comment?
Yeah, I was like, boring, please get over this.
So she's one of the actresses on the show, and most people don't like her character. She was really good singing, though. And so I posted that, and I loved your comment, was boring. And then she actually saw me, I tagged her in the photo on Instagram, and she comments to Al. She's like, thanks, Dr. Bill Nye. So great. I was dying.
And you're like, no, he's not a friend of mine. I don't know him.
We were just cracking up that she responded to your comment.
I was very entertained.
That was so funny. Anyway, how are you doing, man? How was your birthday? How was life?
Birthday was mediocre.
Okay.
I ended up, we just did a big training. We had all our business partner, well, we're like family and friends, but like we were all together and did a facilitated training. We needed to get better at stuff. Normally when you start a company, you have that moment where like you and your founding people, you sit together in a room and you say, all right, we're going to do this for real. What do you really, really suck at? And what are you really good at? And then you kind of talk about it, and then you say, well, oh, yeah, so you're not good at sending emails. Well, that's kind of how I do things, and let's figure out how we're going to work around that. And like then you, but it's just kind of out in the open. Well, since our company has grown very organically, just sort of at its own pace, we never had all right, this is going to be our real deal from here forward. And so we've all just kind of gravitated towards our comfort spots and never really had these discussions. And so that was really good. We ended up doing this training that got a lot of that out. We worked through a bunch of stuff and figured out our strategic moves. And that was great. And so coming out of that, I felt like a huge weight had been lifted off my shoulders, which was a good birthday present. The downside of that birthday present was that it didn't come with chocolate. And so that was disappointing. But all in all, I'd say it was good.
There's a Dollar General in town. I don't know what's stopping you.
There is. There is a Dollar General.
Go to the Dollar General.
Let's see. Then that's pretty much it, man. I had a good weekend just hanging out, riding motorcycles. A lot of motorcycle soccer happening lately, which is a delightful game we play on these motorcycles. We have these mini bikes. They're like pit bikes.
Yeah, I know your mini bikes. Yeah, I've seen those.
Dude, they're so much fun. We have 10 of those everybody in my family has gone in and bought their own. And so we all have one now. We keep them at my sister's house. And we play motorcycle soccer. And we're getting more and more daring, which is more and more dangerous. In the beginning, we were very cautious and stuff wouldn't go. Now we're like trying to connect these big elaborate headers and, you know, chesters into the bike, and then we're knocking each other over to get the ball back. Like, it's turning a little bit crazy. And so we may die soon. This may be my last time with you guys tonight.
I'd like to
make the most of it.
Here's what you do. Change it to motorcycle polo. Change it up a little bit. Get some.
No, we tried. So that's how we played it the first time. We had rackets we were hitting the ball with, but but then you're stuck on the one side, right? And so you've got your hand on a throttle, and that's the hand that always has to be there.
Of course.
And
yeah,
so sure. when you're jumping and moving around and stuff, that hand on the throttle has a tendency to surprise you, and gets a little funky.
That's understandable.
But go ahead.
But then you can just stand up and let the bike take off so you don't die. You just stand up.
No, when you're standing on the bike and jerking the throttle, that's when you do die, Jeff.
Okay.
That is your death.
Okay, fair enough.
Let's see. Oh, and then I had I gave my talk on Sunday, which was
How was that?
Testimony, the difference between faith, belief, and knowing. I was kind of surprised. I got a lot of compliments on it, which most people typically tell me just to stop talking. And so, you know, it was indicative of something that people had been like sort of wanting to hear for a while. I thought I had a lot of people that sort of made the comment of like, yeah, my faith and belief in the church is very similar to what you described there. The angle I ended up taking, and this was interesting because it was, and I appreciated, we had a lot of listeners that sent in some notes and ideas and stuff. You know, because I was struggling with the angle to take. When I give a talk, I try and, you know, I just try and base it off of a couple of experiences that I've had and sort of use those to extrapolate principles and then teach from there. And I couldn't think of anything that really articulated well you know, where the dichotomy was between these three and what we were doing, you know, what we were doing as a church. And where I ended up sort of settling in was around this tendency we all have to use these very, I guess, high level words, right? We'll jump right to amazing and right to awesome.
Right.
And you know, I remember going out as a missionary and saying, I know Joseph Smith is a prophet. And then I came home as a missionary and I said, I know. And I knew a lot more at the end of my mission than I did at the beginning, just because I'd spent more time on it. But I still didn't have any other words for it. And I kept trying to find other words that would adequately demonstrate my increase in faith in this event that took place and in this prophet. And I couldn't find it. And I was really frustrated with the fact that, you know, you're looking for like a more eloquent way of saying, I have faith that Joseph Smith went into a grove of trees and saw God the Father and Jesus Christ, and that happened. And so, I mean, we're scrambling for like a new way of saying that, so that people will appreciate that we've had this sort of coming of age religiously, and we're stuck. We end up just sticking right at that awesome, amazing level of I know, and you know, I ended up sort of using the phrase. I was like, you know, when I'm talking to people and you say that, I mean, there's always a part of you that's like wondering if they wink, wink, really know. Uh-huh. And I think in the church, most of us don't wink, wink, really know most of the stuff that we say that we know. And so I just, you know, in the end, I was like, I'd encourage us to be okay with I have faith, and I had, you know, my faith has grown, and this experience has given me more faith, rather than feeling like we need to say we know. One of our listener emails that came in, Jeff, you actually sent this to me. It came in through Facebook.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
And let me pull it up real quick. Must no, not faster. That one.
Must go faster.
Here it is.
Must go faster.
But he said, let's see. Yeah. So he gave the example of in Ether 3:19, where he talks about how you know, once he knew, he had faith no longer, because he knew he had a perfect knowledge. Mm-hmm. He says, he knew, nothing doubting. As a student of science pretty much my entire adult life, I know what it takes for someone to be able to say, I know something is true. It is a painful process getting to that point. And even then, that point is often only reached in the realm of perception and not reality. In science, we never say, I know that this is true. We only tend to accept as truths observations that have stood up against scientific scrutiny. And the longer the hypothesis or observation stands, the more confidence I have in accepting it as truth. But I will always doubt. Doubt provides the atmosphere for faith to grow. And so, like, just putting an emphasis on faith. I mean, it was actually, it was a really interesting talk for me to try and put together. I had some great examples with some people in my life where I've, like, my prayer has actually been, you know, hey, God, if you would give me an angel, if I could really genuinely know, wink, 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 then I could go to this guy and I could tell him that I know. And then he would, like, the downside of that is he'd believe on my words, right? He'd believe in me. But I'm always impressed how little that stuff actually matters. You know, when I went down and saw the Three Witnesses of the Book of Mormon monument in Richmond, Missouri, I'm so surprised. You know, we had Joseph Smith that saw this stuff. Then the Three Witnesses that also touched and handled the plates via an angel. Right? An angel appeared to them, let them touch it. All that stuff happens. And they all testify of this.
Yeah.
And the world, I mean, the world, like, they're looking for some sort of a proof or something. And these are more people that saw and, like, physically touched and said, no, this is real. This is a real thing. And nobody cares. Right. And we don't care because that's not what faith in the gospel of Jesus Christ is about. And we find ways of excusing that. And so that's not going to change anything. We think that it will. So anyway, it was a fun talk to mull on. Cool stuff to do.
And also,
I like that I just burned up your entire intro.
No, I don't care. I've got no intro. Second. It's great. Also, would like to recognize that DJ wrote in. Just to mention, last week as part of when we were talking about Al Sacrament meeting talk, we mentioned how much, I guess you could say, we lament when the prevalence of talks being geared around general conference talks, that your assignment
just like, oh, shoot, that's what I was going to do.
Yeah, so I love that we got this email from DJ that said, great, well, I listened to your podcast decrying talks based on general conference talks. Now I think I need to rewrite the whole thing. So thanks, I guess. So, but DJ, we're happy to help. Sure, you did a great job. Sure, it was wonderful either way. Not that worried about it. But yeah, we got a handful, a good bit of listener email last week, actually.
We can do one more. A good friend of mine from the college days, Ryan McGee, wrote in. Very cool dude.
This is a great email.
Yeah, well, we were talking last week. I'll set it up, Jeff. You can read it if you want.
Okay, you lob it.
Yeah. Let me. I'll bump set. You spike it down.
This will be an alley oop.
I'll be alley. You be oop. So we were talking last week about Thomas S. Monson, President Monson, and some of the, you know, like what it would be like to have a prophet with dementia. And I even, you know, I had several conversations about it this week. Just sort of about, you know, what happens when somebody gets old or loses their short-term memory or if they get sick or whatever it is. And we talked about that a little bit on the show, just sort of prefacing, you know, President Monson does actually, we believe, I mean, we don't know this, but like we suspect that he's battling with some of that. And so Ryan wrote in and had an experience with him that he shared with us.
Yeah.
Jeff, go.
I'm going to take it. So Ryan still lives in Hawaii, and he works at a hotel down there. And so I believe when they rededicated the Laie Temple, which I think was like, what, a year ago or so, it turns out President Eyring and President Monson stayed at the hotel where he worked. So he was fortunate enough, as he says, to be working the front desk and got to check in the prophet and President Eyring. Now, when he handed a pen to President Monson so he could fill out his paperwork, mid-signature President Monson stopped and turned to President Eyring and just said, Hank, is this your pen or mine? And then President Eyring said, it's neither. It belongs to this young man. President Monson looked bewildered, and he referenced how he said, sometimes you can tell President Monson looks a little, for some fleeting moments, just a little kind of lost, a little bit bewildered. But I like this, because Ryan says he admits he was disappointed with the entire exchange. Because he says, I was expecting to receive a spiritual confirmation that Thomas S. Monson was a prophet of God, but instead, I walked away thinking he was a funny old man with dementia. However, two nights later, they went to the cultural celebration held at BYU Hawaii, and President Monson spoke to the youth. And through that, he's come to realize that there's a big difference between Thomas S. Monson, the man, versus Thomas S. Monson, the prophet. In much the same vein, there was a difference between Joseph Smith, the man, and Joseph Smith, the prophet. So he did get the confirmation he was looking for, but it happened when President Monson was fulfilling his calling. And I loved this email because it hit the nail right on the head in that President Monson may be suffering from things, but you can see a difference when the mantle of the prophetship is upon him and he's speaking with the Spirit. You can see that he becomes crystal clear. And I don't think that's merely because he's reciting things he said before in sermons or stuff like that. You know, it's not just memory triggers or anything along those lines. I mean, you can truly see that prophetic mantle demonstrate itself, manifest itself when the prophet speaks. In his regular life, he might be a little lost and bewildered. He might be at home struggling with his daughter trying to take care of him and not really know what's going on. That could very well be happening. But as far as I've seen, you know, that's unfortunate, but I've still seen that the church can be run effectively because the Lord still sustains his prophet. It doesn't mean his prophet's going to be perfect or there won't be some hiccups along the way, you know, but good email. Good email from Ryan. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I mean, it really does. You can tell when he's standing there speaking to you and testifying of the truthfulness of the gospel or sharing some insider story that has inspired him over the years. I mean, you can tell when they're speaking with their faculties about them versus when they're just sort of not there. And President Monson in conference, I can't remember a single time where he got up to speak and I had that impression that he wasn't fully cognizant of where he was and what he was doing. And I mean, just a testament to a prophet's call, right?
Yeah, definitely. So, to switch gears a little bit here. So, Robin Williams passed away this week, right?
That was the worst. It's just terrible.
It was terrible. And I mean, credit, by the way, to the news app Circa, because I got a quick little flashy sound and an alert that had happened way before it even showed up on Twitter. And so I don't know how they do what they do. But so I was sitting there minding my own business and that showed up and I was like, we're like, what? And then, of course, the news started rolling in and terrible news. I mean, Robin Williams is a legend, both in comedy, even in dramatic roles. Obviously, Al and I have a soft spot for many of his works. Hook is painfully obvious as one of them, but of course we like a lot of other things he did.
And he was in the middle of shooting Mrs. Doubtfire 2.
I don't know if they were shooting it or if they... I think it was just in the planning stages.
There is no justice in this world.
No, to be honest, I think the justice is that we didn't have to deal with an unnecessary sequel 20 years after the fact. But, sorry, I shouldn't say justice. You know what I mean. But this is just... It's terrible news. And it's terrible news not just because we lost someone. It's terrible news because, as the sheriff's department said, he killed himself. He hanged himself with a belt. So Robin Williams was suffering from severe depression and committed suicide. And this has sparked... go ahead.
I think that's why... Well, I think that's why it got to me as much as it did is because this is a guy that... I mean, and people like this, you know, you can identify with sometimes, but they're... On the outside, everything's great, right? You never think of Robin Williams, the guy who makes everybody happy, and think, oh, he must be aching on the inside. You just don't, like, that thought never crosses your mind. And a lot of people, I mean, there's a lot of people that I know. There's a lot of people in my life that are really, really good at being positive, happy people, and the struggles of life are very real, even for people that smile a lot, right? And we look at them, we say, they've got it all figured out. They're golden. I mean, people like Jeff who travel all the time and and have this life. I mean, there's still a part of you, like, to be able to appreciate, though, what some of these people are going through, because you feel incredibly alone, part of you, because you feel like if you open that door to anybody, nobody's very interested in seeing that side of you, right? They come to you to be lifted and filled, exactly. rather than coming to you for, you know, so that you can be filled and lifted. And so, you know, with Robin Williams, you look at him and you're just like, man, the fact that he probably had very, very few people who had any idea where he was with all this stuff, and that he felt alone enough to the point that taking his life was his way of battling
his only way out, yeah.
Right?
And you see, the interesting thing is you see many actors, especially comedic actors, who struggle with depression or drug abuse. And Robin Williams was open about his struggles with alcoholism and even cocaine abuse throughout his life. What I feel like this has really sparked is an interesting conversation on concepts of depression. And this is across the board. This is not because, as many of you saw, we posted a thing on the page the other day about the stupid Matt Walsh blog, which I think I'm pretty much done ever mentioning on the show again after this point. Which basically said that, of course, Robin Williams still made a choice in the end. Now, in principle and on paper, sure, everyone makes a choice. But we know that people who suffer from depression, which is like a disease, it's like it's a treatable condition. It's something that people struggle with. There's chemical imbalances in play. A lot of things are going on with depression. That not everyone's making decisions with a sound mind. You're not sitting there rationally weighing your options and saying, yep, really thought it through here. I've got option A, option B, and option C, and I really think ending it all is the only one that makes sense to me. You're not thinking along those lines. You're depressed and you don't know why half the time. And that whole piece by Matt Walsh just blew my mind. And go ahead if you want. I've got some stuff to support this, but go ahead, Alex.
I didn't even bother reading that blog post because I knew what it was doing. But the I always think of like astronauts. Well, I don't know that this is true, but I've been told that they have they have that pill that'll kill them, right? Like that
cyanide capsule. Yeah.
Yeah. The instant death pill. In the event that like they're out doing a walk and get disconnected and off they float, right? Like that idea that rather than floating until you die.
Until you
days
suffocate
and days later.
Or your blood boils from being in space. Yeah, exactly.
That you could just take your life and be done. I mean, once all hope is lost, that's your move, right? And I think of what that mentality must be. You know, at what point do you say, they're never going to find me. I'm giving up and I'm out. I'm done. And this is my, you know, all hope is lost. And you compare that to, you know, say Robin Williams, right? I mean, to be in that same mindset, it's sure it is a choice. And I don't understand necessarily depression and the chemical imbalances, all that. I understand my own, you know, my own battles with some of this stuff. And it's not, I don't think I have anything close to what a lot of people suffer from, but I have a tendency to put on a happy face and there's very few people that are sort of in that inner circle that I get to confide in with what's really going on in my life. And I think a lot of us are actually that way. And so that idea that you could run into that state of mind of just, mm-hmm. it's all black from here on out. And I don't see it getting any better. I mean, that's something that I can understand in somebody, you know, like a Brian Williams, or not Brian Williams, a Robin Williams sort of scenario. And so, I mean, sure, it's a choice, but it's a choice that I'm sure he thinks is like the most humane choice for him. I mean, I don't know. And I don't know if it's healthy to even talk about suicide this way, because you don't want to promote the idea of people thinking that it's an option, really. I mean,
well, no, and it doesn't.
Don't do it. You can get help. You can work through it. But like at the same time, it does us no good to shame people that have gone through that or that took that way out. Right.
Yeah. And of course though, I mean, it is difficult because when one does that, you're not there for the aftermath, you know, for the pain and the heartache of everyone around you who is not just sad like you would be if a loved one passed away, but sad because of the tragedy of the whole thing. And in many ways that's unfair, but I still think we fail to recognize that for the most part, when these things happen, it is because people are in such a dark place and they feel they can't get out. And that's when we need to be as compassionate as possible and do our very, very best to be there for people and to help them and to positively affirm them. I mean, my own brother is very publicly and open about the fact that he's a bipolar manic depressive. And he owns it and he knows what he is and he knows what problems he suffers from. And it's not always easy for him. And I see it, like he gets up some days and you can tell he's just like, dude, I like have no will to like even exist right now. You know, and that's not by choice. That's not something he's trying to accomplish or he's trying to get people to feel sorry for him. And I've known many other friends who have struggled with these things, and they're very real issues. And one thing I'm glad about is that I think it's been very easy for us to default and say suicide is a sin because it is the taking of a life, one's own, correct? But if we look at things that the church has published, we have a little bit more of a tempered view on the matter. You have some remarks by Elder M. Russell Ballard, for example, in a talk. He said basically that I feel the Lord also recognizes differences in intent and circumstances. Only the Lord knows all the details, and he it is who will judge our actions here on earth. And that really echoes what it says actually in Handbook Number 2. Handbook Number 2, which is open to everybody, actually says that it is wrong to take a life, including one's own. Yes. However, a person who commits suicide may not be responsible for his or her acts. Only God can judge such a matter. And I think that's, and of course, only God can judge it. But it's absolutely true. Not everyone who does things is doing so with a sound mind. And if one person could, if you could plead insanity for murdering other people, then in many ways, how would that be any other different in terms of personal culpability if it involved oneself? And obviously, we never endorse that. There's always hope. There's always a way out. If any of you are listening as our listeners who struggle with these things, hopefully you have a good support system. But if not, you know, hang in there. Reach out to people. Reach out to us. You know, we're whatever. We want everyone to be okay. Absolutely. The Robin Williams thing definitely highlights an important issue that does exist very much in our church, and we try to pretend it doesn't. So I'm glad that we, as Latter-day Saints, hopefully are opening ourselves up to understanding the realities of depression and how people aren't just freaks without hope or anything like that, that we actually have friends that we love that we can help.
Well, it really is. I mean, it really is a tough conversation, though, because there's a part of it that, like, if you celebrate somebody that commits suicide, then other people that are contemplating that look at this and say, that's the sort of going away that I want. You know, there's a part of it that, like, it's almost like a disease that spreads, right? Yeah. Like when it happens when you were in high school, all of a sudden it happens like 3 or 4 times in that year. And I mean, they pull in the counselors and they like start battling this stuff in a very real way because it's almost contagious. So there's that side of it, but man, like have some empathy for people that are at this point. I mean, with Robin Williams especially, I feel like it's so easy to look at him and just say, man, I'm so sorry. Like I'm so sad that this is where you ended. Like this is that you were in this place and that you didn't go out on top in your own mind. You went out, mm-hmm. Struggling and down in the blackest of holes. And so, I mean, just man, a great big hug will go a lot further in this stuff than almost anything else. And so the more of that you can send around, like anybody that's struggling with this, I mean, that's quality conversations. Reach out to people, be good. Like let this sort of inspire you, to go and fix, you know, I mean, the idea that conversation or that one thing that says, hey, you talking to this person, say you're important to me. Yeah. I'm glad you're here. Thanks for being here today. Could like change their life. We should do more of that.
And get that professional help. I mean, look, bishops are wonderful men, but 99% of them are not trained psychological counselors. And so get that professional counsel with your bishop to obtain other professional help if that's the avenue you want to go to through, you know, family services or whatever. But get that help. There is no shame in going to therapy. There is no shame in needing medications to help work on something. There's no shame in any of that at all, in any way, shape, or form. So do what you have to do. Definitely.
True that.
We'll miss you, Robin.
Yeah, man, we really will. That's crummy. Let's see. So, trying to see where to go from here.
Hurry up, Al. I have 2 minutes left. I'm just kidding.
Let's see. There's a pretty decent article. We'll do some of the Mormon feminist movement stuff real quick.
Oh, right. It's time for the Mormon Feminist Hour. Yes.
So Sharon Eubanks and the Tonight Show band, Sharon Eubank.
Kevin Eubanks? Who, what? Whatever.
Sharon Eubank. She's a LDS philanthropist or like a humanitarian aid official person.
Okay.
She's got an article here by Peggy Fletcher Stack where she was interviewed and makes some good points. This is one of those sort of if ordained women was this, I would be all about it, right? Comments. Some stuff here where she's just saying that how women are treated in the church doctrinally is not represented in how women are treated in the church in practice, mm-hmm. and that we should fix a lot of that, which we all agree with, right? There's stuff where women have a much larger role in the priesthood than what their title sort of allows. And I'm like, I agree with that. I agree with the idea that we could more adequately articulate women's contribution to the priesthood. Maybe like one of the examples she uses also is that like a woman, the mission president's wife, you know, we call her the mission president's wife, and her role is much bigger than the wife to the mission president. It's like she has duties and things that she takes care of.
She receives a calling. I mean, yeah, this isn't just like, hey, by the way, your husband's going to be the mission president, support him. I mean, she's also receives a calling at the same time.
And well, we talk about this a lot, sort of how the, you know, the idea that a Sunday school president typically is not a woman. It's not in there, and there's no reason that it shouldn't be.
Yeah, I don't know what that one is. It does say in the handbook, though, that it should be a priesthood holder, but I don't know why. It just says that.
Right. But that's the idea. Sort of that that level of engagement, I think, is a great place to start for like how can we help to articulate the, you know, how the church should be viewing women, how women should feel treated in the church. These are simple things that we could start addressing that would make a big difference, I feel like. And so I liked this article. I thought it was well done. And this lady, Sharon Eubank, seems like a smart gal, and I appreciated her insights.
In other related women's news, so this one is just spectacular. This is in Cosmo, so read it at your own risk. I don't think it's that graphic, but, you know, it's Cosmo. It's not like it's...
I don't think it's that graphic.
Okay, I don't think it's graphic. It doesn't go
trigger into alert. She kisses a boy.
It doesn't. There it is. It's graphic for BYU Idaho. So this is a fascinating article, and I don't understand what the point of it entirely is. So it's called "I'm Fighting BYU's Ban on Sex." At Brigham Young University, of course, students sign an honor code where they promise to lead a chaste life.
She represents the interests of every freshman at BYU.
Pretty much. Kelly Byers is trying to change the standards. So she talks about growing up in Washington State. She was told to save sex till marriage, et cetera, you know, all that stuff. Unfortunately, I feel like she had the bad experience when it comes to teachers. Like, teachers in the church would chew gum and say, "Would you want this now that I've used it?" That kind of stuff, which I think is very, very
counterproductive. I feel like we use a lot of those stories to sort of sensationalize pieces like this. Maybe she did, maybe she didn't, but it sure makes the piece better.
We use very counterproductive metaphors, though. I think a lot of the time, the way we try to teach these principles, you hear it from enough women, I assume these things are true. You know, why would you drive the car? Whatever. So, she blah blah blah. So when she was in her 20s, and this is of course another thing that's sad and has likely affected her experiences, a guy in his 20s just come home from his mission, sexually assaulted her. She'd never kissed a boy. It was scary. She told her parents and her bishop. She was banned from church for a month. So she was punished because a guy touched her. I don't doubt this was true because every bishop is different. And unfortunately, it seems very weird because victims of sexual assault are victims of sexual assault and should not be banned for anything. And it's not the questions of, you know, what were you wearing at the time? Were you doing anything to entice him? It's like, dude, it doesn't matter what you did. If the guy sexually assaulted you, the guy sexually assaulted you. Bottom line. That's a bit of a tangent.
Yeah.
So point is, she signed the honor code at BYU,
Well, so now she's a sexual woman, she says.
I guess. Her attitude changed after she joined...
I'm not sure how the sexual assault feeds into her being a sexual creature that needs more outlets.
Well, I have found, and forgive me for generalizing, I've known women friends who have been sexually assaulted in one way or another in those earlier years. Ones who have been, you know, by and large, good. Okay, and haven't been fooling around, haven't been leading any kind of a life like that. And I've found that it is extremely damaging to one's soul and to one's state of well-being with regard to what's appropriate with men. I've known many women, even while at BYU, who had been sexually assaulted, date raped or something, back when they were 19 or 20. And like, where does this come from? You know, you're like, what the heck? I'm trying to go to BYU and live a good life with Mormon guys, and this happens to me. And I've seen stuff come off the rails in pretty unfortunate ways, where instead sex becomes this sort of numb thing that is pursued in many instances. And I don't know if that's the case for her, but I've definitely seen it skew and hurt people to an extent that they I don't know if they revel in sex necessarily, but it becomes a warped way of looking at things. So the point is, she joined Young Mormon Feminist, which of course is not endorsed by the church nor BYU, and honestly they post more radical stuff than ordained women. And of course, you know, she goes on about how the church isn't equal and how the honor code enforces, you know, BYU is into slut shaming, which is a hilarious term that goes around a lot. and blah, blah, blah. And it's true. I think it's totally messed up if women are getting the bad end of a deal in instances of assault.
Well, BYU is hypersensitive to any of this.
Sure.
To anything sexual at all. I mean, to the point, like, I loved you were telling me about the letter to the editor about the single strap book bags that accentuated a woman's breasts.
Yeah.
And how, you know, the men were calling for that to stop, or like the well-intentioned idiot boys who write a note saying, hey, your shirt is too tight fitting.
Which is all
that
stupid. I can
tell that you're a female.
All that's stupid. And she does say, of
course.
But you're
going to run into that at BYU because it's sort of a stupid culture.
Yeah. And so I think it's unfortunate when one is struggling with BYU culture, but I also don't understand the point of this article where she's saying, I'm a sexual woman and a proud feminist, and I don't feel bad about it. And so this might get me in trouble with BYU. Yeah, it probably is going to get her in trouble with BYU. She's probably going to get kicked out of BYU now. I mean, it's in Cosmo.
All she says she goes on Tinder and finds boys to drive to Squaw Peak and make out and do everything but sex.
Yeah, everything
but. I don't feel like that can get you kicked out.
Okay, she's fine. She's set. No worries. This will be like the 70s. Anyway, but
I like that this is under the guise of a petition to get sex allowed at BYU.
Yeah, it's I have decided that I like to fool around and don't feel bad about it because it's limiting and the church is sexist and yada, yada, yada. And so,
hey, Jeff, when you're wrong, it's a lot easier for the church to be wrong or for the school to be wrong than it is for you to be wrong. It's a much easier road back.
I feel like what's unfortunate here, though, is that there are deeper issues at play, I think, that affect one's own emotional well-being and understanding of these things. I'm not shaming her in any way, but obviously she's had experiences that have taken her down a different path and that have, I think, in many ways warped her view about how things as they should be. Lastly, quick.
Come back. Don't go to Squaw Peak with boys on Tinder. It's a trap.
Never do it.
Stop that madness.
Last lady. Quick mention for the Mormon Feminist Hour. So we missed this, actually. We talked about, in all the ordained women aftermath stuff, how their six discussions are really what we feel got them into hot water, right? So ordained women has capitulated a little bit and changed their six discussions to six conversations.
Oh, yeah.
So the six discussions were modeled after an LDS missionary strategy for teaching potential converts. But the group does not seek members or followers, as it says on their website. So they're just trying to have conversations.
Well, that's a great step. That's a great gesture towards kind of leaving some of the stuff that was getting him into trouble. I'll accept that. It's a good gesture.
It might just be lip service, but that's okay.
Not going to fix
it. Moving along, Al.
Also, Jeff, let's talk about how Mormon temples are expensive.
Okay, I think he said the whole article.
Did you know this? Corey Adwar figured this out. He looked at the San Diego temple and said, hold up, that can't be cheap to build. And then he wrote an article on it. So Reuters reported that meeting houses and temples are worth an estimated $35 billion. $35 billion. That's a good holdings for any organization to have. The church, I like that they build temples of God and that we can go into them and use them. I feel like it's a good use of funds. So bravo, good work. The meeting houses are typically community accessible, right? Like if somebody else in the community wanted to hold their reception there or something of that nature, typically they wouldn't have a problem. Though if you weren't Mormon, I don't know why you'd want to tolerate the basketball hoops at your reception. But sometimes that is.
Ooh,
and so sorry. I mean, this guy's onto something, though. He thinks that there's actually money in the banana stand. So good work, Corey.
It's so true. Speaking of the basketball hoop, I read an article this week that I can't cite because I'm just regurgitating this from memory.
Interesting
story about meeting houses in Africa, particularly in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and how the church had initially built much nicer meeting houses than the local population was accustomed to, and put in basketball courts, which is not really the sport of choice amongst Congolese people. It's football. And so, interesting article on how eventually working with a mission president who saw that this made no sense for the people, they actually got Salt Lake to amend their plans and construct buildings that made more sense for the locals. Usually I haven't seen a problem with this. Like on my mission in Spain, everyone played soccer. And if we had any freestanding buildings, they had a soccer court. They didn't have a basketball court. I mean, basketball is reasonably popular in Spain, but it's nothing compared to soccer. So maybe we're still just kind of learning the ropes in Africa. And I know that the church, you can find this online, actually. You go to the church architect's website, and they have pre-approved plans for every major region of the church. I guess we just have some things to still learn. I mean, they were talking building materials and just stuff that made no sense for the locals. So they've actually been building cheaper buildings that are basically huts that the locals are happier with because it doesn't feel too too grandiose.
I would love a meeting house configuration that had a sort of like an indoor patio area that was a soccer court.
I had a building on my mission that was in a more urban area. The whole building was like 6 stories tall, and the top level of the whole thing was actually an indoor soccer court that ran the length of the building. This whole upper level.
Pretty
cool, actually. That was a cool building. I enjoyed that one. Here's to you, Cornelia. Good job.
Good job.
Well done. Let's see. Other great things. There's an article from Bryce Moore's blog. It says, HBO and Netflix, please stop pornifying good shows. And the article pretty much just says HBO and Netflix are putting too many boobs in their TV shows. And they're great shows outside of sort of the sex moments. Things like Breaking Bad had that.
Breaking Bad was on AMC. There wasn't boobs on that show.
Typically, so in my experience with these shows, this is what happens. In the first two or three episodes, they're sort of struggling to figure out where their line is or what they need to do. And so they throw in a lot more sort of sex stuff, than you'll see in the rest of the seasons.
Yes. But you could say that, sometimes. But this guy talks more about, especially shows on HBO, Game of Thrones, for example. Sure. Game of Thrones has become notorious.
Netflix has Orange is the New Black and House of Cards. Both have gratuitous.
They have lots of nudity and stuff like that. And Game of Thrones has been infamous for it, because it seems like they've actually added more of it in as the show has gone on. And this is sort of what this guy's talking about. Like, dude, why are you like? It seems over the top with the inclusion of nudity. It's not like it furthers the plot. It's just there because you think.
No, this is the sad reality, though. It's not about storytelling. It's about audience building, right? It's about getting the number of viewers, and people are going to be more apt to tune in if there's sex there.
Potentially,
it's the nature of marketing. But it's what happens.
But will all people? I mean, I know Game of Thrones appeals a lot to men, but it appeals to a lot of women who I can't imagine are loving the whatever. Another interesting thing, I'd love to get a poll on this, folks, and if you respond to
I feel like you mumbled there at the end.
I did. If you respond...
Your point didn't land with a resounding thud.
If you respond to us by email, if you want to contact at thisweekinmormons.com, I would love to understand, personally, active Mormon men and women, whatever, who watch, say, Game of Thrones, shows that depict graphic sexuality, and why that is not bothersome to one who is striving to avoid... I'm not even going to just say R-rated movies, but one is struggling to avoid things that are like pornography or whatever else. You could say because it shows the bad consequences of violence and sexual violence. But even so, I'd be curious as to people's insights on this, because it's never fully made sense to me. And I don't want to sound like I'm judging, I'm not condemning, but I want to understand that mindset for people. Like, you know, you're hunky-dory about stuff and you're like, yeah, I sit around with my wife and we watch Game of Thrones and we're watching people, you know, do it. I feel like that would be.
I can't imagine how two guys could.
I feel like that would be an awkward and strange experience, and so that's all. That's all.
Sure, Jeff. I appreciate that. I don't subscribe to the Game of Thrones stuff mainly because of that. Like, I would love to give it a shot, but I know full well going into it what's there, and so I opt out.
And I too, I think it would be interesting, but I'm not.
But it makes me sad. I mean, so I agree with him a little bit that it's sad to be excluded from some of this. But if you read the book, I mean, the books aren't going to be they're not going to be that much better. It's still really rough stuff. And so if you make a TV show out of this stuff, I mean, don't be surprised, right? Like, don't be surprised. And Netflix made House of Cards strictly on data. So they knew that, like, political thrillers trended well, and they knew the Kevin Spacey stuff was they put it together in this way that was like, let's use all the data we have. And so of course they're going to sprinkle some sex stuff in there, because that's going to make it not too much. I mean, it's not so much that it's over the top, but it's just enough to like keep the male audience engaged in it while the female audience I don't know. I think there's plenty of females that genuinely enjoy a lot of that stuff and tolerate it for the same reasons that men do. Not that men are particularly chasing that quote unquote pornography in these different TV shows, but you tolerate it for the rest of the story, and then it just sort of leads you down a path, so to speak. Right.
There we go. All right.
I think that's what happens.
All right, we're going to wind down here. A couple quick mention here. The church sent about $100,000 in goods to northern Iraq to aid Christians, of course, who are escaping the onslaught of ISIS up there. So that's great. I almost feel like $100,000 is too little. I'm like, why are we send $1 million of aid? What are we doing?
Well, no. The quote in there is the same as that we mentioned before, where their trouble isn't that they don't have the money to send, it's that they don't have a meaningful way to distribute it, right?
Yeah.
So, the challenge is finding people or organizations who can deliver the aid.
Which is why we should become a bigger NGO where we deliver the aid ourselves.
Hear.
Anyway, but that's great. Of an interesting note, though, there's a little footnote in this article about it. We also sent stuff to Gaza, which I think is just interesting for discussion among Mormons, simply because, you know, we talk about whether, I don't think the church is saying they support Hamas or anything along those lines, but the church is pretty openly saying there's still a humanitarian catastrophe in Islamic Gaza, and we're sending money there. We're not sending money to Israel to give them aid. We're sending aid into Gaza to help them out, which, given some of the stuff we've seen the past couple of weeks, I thought that was rather interesting that the church was involved in that.
Well, the church has taken up that banner of, or they try to, of give us your suffering huddled masses.
Al, let's close out with the Mormon TV show or the Korean TV show. Al,
this is great. Our good friend Russell Stevenson shared this on Facebook, and I loved it. In 1994, four Korean missionaries went on a Korean singing competition. Which I'm assuming was to get more visibility for the church. You know how you do a lot of that stuff as a missionary, and you're like, all right, well, I'm going to go, and we're going to do this thing, and the news is going to come and cover us, and it's going to be really good. So they did sort of I don't know what it is. In my mind, it's a Ed McMahon's,
That was called Star Search.
Star Search, yes. That's how it is in my mind. These four guys come out dressed ridiculously as over-the-top Americans and sing this song. I was very entertained. It made me really happy.
It's really funny. I love it. I wish I could have gone on some kind of a program like this when I was a missionary. Oh.
Anyway, Jeff.
That's going to be it.
You have a great week,
folks. Send us an email, contact at thisweekinmormons.com. We love hearing from you. And if you're...
Tell Jeff why you love pornography.
Yeah, please do. And also, because I'm an Elders Quorum president. I have keys.
Please
whatever
do.
That means. But also, shoot us an email in general. If your email is compelling enough, we might read it on the air like we did this week. But in general, we love hearing from you. Go to thisweekinmormons.com and visit us and subscribe to the other podcasts, Sunday School Bonanza, Third Hour of Power, all that stuff. Do it. It's great.
3 hours of powers. Yeah, do it.
Do the social media. We do the social media plug, Al. That's your job.
Oh, yeah. Facebook.com/thisweekinmormons and Twitter.com @TheRealTwim. Also on the Instagram.
Oh, we've been rocking. No, we're this we have been Mormons rocking the Instagram lately. It's been good.
You do good work, Jeff.
Thank you kindly. Al, I hope this week is even better than last week for you.
Oh, yeah, it will be. It's going to be awesome.
And to our listeners, I hope that this week is even better than last month for all of you.
Wherever we may find you.
And now we leave.
Send Jeff emails.
And now we leave you about from the shadow of the mountains and the hills, or whatever Lloyd Newell says right then. I don't know.
Uh-huh.
I don't know what he says.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, we're going to leave now. Al, have a good one, dude.
All right.
See you, buddy. Thanks for listening to TWIM, everyone. Appreciate you taking the time to do it. Can't do it without you. So listen in next week for more great Mormon news and commentary on This Week in Mormon.
Master, I don't think you quite realize what you've got here. So why don't you just ruminate whilst I illuminate the possibilities? Well, Alibaba had them 40 thieves. Sherazade had 1,000 tails. But Master, you in luck, cause up your sleeves, you got a brand of magic never fails. You got some power in your corner now. Some heavy ammunition in your camp. You got some punch, pizzazz. Your blue and house, all you gotta do is rub that lamp. And I'll say,
Mr. Aladdin, sir, what will your pleasure be?
Let me take your order, jot it down. You ain't never had a friend like me. wife is your restaurant, and I'm your maitre d'. Come on, whisper what it is you want. You ain't never had a friend like me.
Yes, sir, we pride ourselves on service.
You're the boss, the king, the Shah.
Say what you wish, it's yours, true dish. About a little more baklava. Has some of column A, try all of column B. I'm in the mood to help you, dude. You ain't never had a friend like me. Mama. No, no. Can your friends do better?